This is All of It from WNYC. I'm Kusha Navadar. We just passed the one-month mark. We're in the final leg of the submission period for the Public Song Project. If you want a chance to be featured on WNYC, you have until May 12th, so still got some time to record your cover or adaptation of a work from the public domain. And today, I'm joined by a special guest contributor to the project, Jonathan Colton, who some listeners might remember as the in-house musician on the WNYC quiz show Ask Me Another, and whose own work has been heavily involved with ideas about intellectual property and free access to music. Colton is just one of a number of friends of WNYC who are a part of this project. That list also includes They Might Be Giants, Valerie June, Rhiannon Giddens, Bella Fleck, and many others whose names we'll be announcing and whose songs we'll be sharing online. And guess what? You could be featured alongside them. So whoever you are, you could be in a band, you might be a working session musician, or you might just pick up an instrument in your free time. Anybody 18 or older is invited to participate. You can find out how to get involved and listen to songs from our guest contributors exclusively on our website. It's wnyc.org/public song project. But first, joining me to talk about his cover of Irving Berlin's All Alone is Brooklyn's own Jonathan Colton. Jonathan, welcome.
Hi, Kusha. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. So what got you interested in this project?
Well, WNYC reached out to me, and I love the idea. I also have kind of been thrilled every time the cycle turns over and a new batch of creative works become public domain. It's kind of an exciting annual event.
Yeah. The song you decided to record is All Alone by Irving Berlin. It's from 1924. How did you land on that song?
You know, I perused a few, and there's a mix of some very wacky novelty songs and some more straight ahead love songs. And I've always been a sucker for a sad song, and this one is particularly sad. It has that sort of over-the-top pathetic sadness that is kind of rare in a song for the writer to actually go that far.
Were there any other particular versions of it that you were already familiar with? Like, did you draw inspiration from other covers?
I listened to a few just to see what was out there. Pat Boone's version was the one that really stuck out for me. I mean, he's got such a beautiful voice and works very well on this song. But, you know, mostly I tried to just really dive into that feeling of sadness and loneliness. You know, I almost think it's hard to tell about the author's original intent, but I almost feel like it's a bit of an over the top in a tongue in cheek way.
Oh,
over the top loneliness. But I'm not sure if I could speak for Irving Berlin that way.
You mean almost like parody or a satire or what? Dive more into that.
Not parody necessarily, but I think it really is leaning into it. I mean, it reminds me of songs like All by Myself by Eric Carmen, or Without You by Harry Nilsson. It's just so incredibly sad that I feel like there has to be a little bit of tongue-in-cheek in there. And especially the line that's in there, you know, in All Alone by the telephone, waiting for a ring, a ting-a-ling, which is a funny little distance from that sadness, I think.
How did you approach the arrangement and recording for the song, keeping in mind that kind of tongue-in-cheekness or whatever flavor you wanted to bring to it? I mean, your cover begins with just your voice and guitar and then layers on more instrumentation, including a very pretty choir. Was that choice to bring out the sadness, or just talk through how you approached the arrangement?
Yeah, I definitely, because it's a two-section song, it's sort of a verse and a refrain, and the refrain is where it really sort of digs in to this feeling of being all alone, and the verse is a little more descriptive. So I wanted to sort of alternate between the, you know, the very lonely sound of just a vocal and an acoustic guitar, and then something sort of more lush and maybe self-indulgent in the refrains. So that's when I brought in the other instruments and layered those vocals in. The vocals, I will say, the vocals that I put in there do have, I think, a tongue-in-cheek quality. They're a little bit you know, purposefully old fashioned by my taste, but I love them. I think they're very charming that way.
You know, speaking of self-indulgent, while you were giving your response, our control room over here was breaking out into All By Myself. So you had you incited a very funny moment over here at WNYC.
Oh, good. Glad to hear it.
We're talking to Jonathan Colton, who is doing a cover of All Alone by Irving Berlin for the Public Song Project. It's available to stream on WNYC.org/public song project. And Jonathan, the Public Song Project celebrates the public domain as a tool for creators. And you're a really interesting artist to talk to for this project, I think, because you release your work in a way that's kind of a similar philosophy. You release all your music with a Creative Commons license. So for listeners who might not be familiar, can you explain what that means for the way someone might find or interact with your music?
Yeah, so a Creative Commons license is a license that you can apply to any creative work, and it sort of sits on top of copyright and allows the creator to give back certain rights that copyright takes away, and you can configure it in various ways. So, for instance, most of my music is released under a Creative Commons license that still retains copyright but allows people to share the music freely, as long as they're not doing that commercially, as long as they're not selling it. And it allows them to reuse it in new works, again, as long as it stays within the non-commercial realm. And I don't know, for me, you know, copyright has always been about finding a balance between creating a kind of exclusive right for the creator so that they can profit from their creative work, but also allowing some public use of that material so that it does benefit the rest of us as a whole. And I think that's what you see in copyright with the idea of copyright expiring is it's not a permanent exclusivity for the artist. It's eventually these works all become available to all, which is kind of a beautiful idea. And in a way, that's what art is for. And so for me personally, I think that's how I want my music to be used. I want people to make their own versions of things and to remix it in various ways and to use it in videos and such. So for me, just being able to declare that at the outset, how I believe my music should go out into the world is that's why I use that Creative Commons license.
It is a beautiful way of looking at, you know, creating and sharing music in the world. Pragmatically, does it make it harder to profit off your music? And if it does, do you try to make money through that in other ways instead?
Yeah, I mean, I find that when music is free and for sale, both channels are active. So there are some people who get it for free and some people who pay for it. And, you know, I don't really have a comparison. I only know what it is that I do and that it works for me. So I can't tell you if I am, you know, if it causes me to make more money or less money. But I will say that I do believe, you know, allowing it certainly in the very beginning of my efforts in this field, allowing my music to circulate as freely as possible was really beneficial to me because I was a complete unknown and I had no record label and no marketing budget. And so, you know, I really relied on the music finding its way to fans. And I think that was a really crucial part of how I was ultimately able to make this career work.
Yeah. And was that part of the idea when you first started doing your music release under Creative Commons that it would expand to a wider audience because of that accessibility? Or was it just something that you realized as you were doing it?
Yeah, it was definitely part of the original plan. I mean, I saw it as a both sides win situation. I was really moved by the beauty of this idea that you put a piece of art out into the world and it sort of floats around like a dandelion seed. Mm-hmm. You don't know where it's gonna land and where it's gonna take root, but it's sort of not yours anymore once you release it into the world. I love that idea, but then you know, I also did suspect that it would have a positive effect on people being able to discover my music who wouldn't have otherwise.
Yeah. Before we go to your song, are there any other work or shows you have coming up that you want to shout out?
I don't have any shows planned currently, but I am eternally working on my annual cruise, the Joco Cruise, which is a week-long sort of Nerd Music Comedy Festival at Sea. So people can check that out. That's not for a while. We just did one in March and it was fantastic, but we'll be doing one again in about a year.
Oh, wonderful. At Sea, Music at the Sea. How wonderful. Yes. Let's hear your cover of All Alone by Irving Berlin. Here it is.
Just like a melody that lingers on, you seem to haunt me night and day. I never realized till you were gone how much I cared about you. I can't live without you. All alone, I'm so all alone. There is no one else but you. All alone by the telephone, waiting for a ring, a ting-a-ling. All alone in the evening. All and if you are all alone too. Just for a moment you were mine, and then you seemed to vanish like a dream. I long to hold you in my arms again. My life is very lonely, for I want you only. All alone, I'm so all alone. There is no one else but you. All alone by the telephone, waiting for a ring, a ting-a-ling. All alone in the evening, all alone feeling blue, wondering where you are and how you are and if you are all alone too. If you are all alone.
You just heard Jonathan Colton's cover of All Alone by Irving Berlin, which is his contribution to the 2024 Public Song Project. And we were just talking to Jonathan Colton, whose submission of the Public Song Project is available to listen to at wnyc.org/Public Song Project. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us. And during our conversation with Jonathan, we got into discussing different ideas and issues related to intellectual property and the arts, what the Creative Commons is, and how it differs from the public domain. So we thought it was worth a brief explainer on all these ideas and why they matter for artists today with someone whose career is dedicated to thinking about them. Michael Weinberg is the executive director of the Engelberg Center on Innovation Law and Policy at the NYU School of Law. Their work includes studying how innovation overlaps with access and property rights, and their projects include Library Futures, a digital library organization. Michael, welcome to All of It.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. So can you give a quick overview of the Engelberg Center and the work you do, especially in the context of what we've been talking about with the Public Song Project?
Absolutely. So the Engelberg Center on Innovation, Law, and Policy here at NYU Law is the place, it says on the tin, you know, we are the place at the law school that really focuses on what it means to have intersections between innovation, law, and policy, how law and policy can encourage innovation, can encourage culture and creation and expression in a really socially beneficial way. And a huge part of what we do is thinking about intellectual property law and how intellectual property law can encourage and protect and engage with culture. And a big part of that is thinking about the public domain. A lot of people, we obviously have a lot of conversations about copyright law and intellectual property law in terms of what they are protecting today. But those negative spaces where there isn't any protection, either because the work has entered the public domain or it was never protected, can also be an incredibly rich space for creativity. And if you want to understand people creating and people innovating, you need to understand those spaces as well.
You know, in my conversation with Jonathan Colton, we got into Creative Commons licenses, which are a different thing from the public domain. So how do these ideas fit within the vast framework of ways of thinking about intellectual property and access to art?
Yeah, they really are complementary ideas, right? We have the public domain, which is made up of works that are not protected by intellectual property law or copyright at all. So these are usually works where the copyright has expired, works that, like for the Public Song Project, where kind of a good rule of thumb is that any creative work made before 1928 is now part of the public domain. It's part of our shared cultural heritage. No one owns the rights anymore. And so if we want to make new covers or new versions, we can do whatever we want with them. Creative Commons is really focused on things that are still protected by copyright. So works that are newer, that are not in the public domain, where someone owns the copyright. And Creative Commons allows that copyright holder to invite other people to use their creations as long as those other people follow some pretty straightforward rules. So instead of saying all rights reserved, you can't do anything, what Creative Commons says is, please use this, remix it, build on it, as long as you do things like give me attribution, or if you build something new, you should also share it in the same way. So it's a way to enrich the commons for works that are still protected by copyright.
When people think of the public domain, they tend to think of stuff from like centuries ago, old stuff. Why do you think that is, and how could it be changing?
Yeah, I mean, part of that is because the public domain is stuff where copyright has expired. And, you know, the length of copyright protection has changed over the years. But it's true that, you know, when you think about public domain things, if you think about Renaissance art or things that are very old, all of those things are in the public domain. They probably were created before there was even copyright protection at all. But one of the exciting things that is happening is a couple of years ago, we had a kind of unfreezing of the public domain. So there was a law in the United States that was passed in the late 90s that kind of froze the public domain for about 20 years, where no new works entered the public domain. And a couple of years ago, that period ended. And so now every year since, we've seen this sort of new entry of works every year. So last year, it was 1927. This year is 1928. Next year, it'll be 1929. And those works, we're finding new ways to use them. And so as they enter the public domain, the public domain feels richer. And some of those works, you know, we're now seeing works that were recorded. So we have, instead of just books or paintings, we have songs, we have recordings of those songs and you know, early movies. And those can feel much more immediate than some of the older works, which are also great, but a different kind of work.
Is artificial intelligence mucking things up? Like, how is that playing into the idea of the public domain now?
Yeah, so artificial intelligence is touching public domain like it's touching everything else. there are a bunch of debates about whether or not, you know, works that are used to train artificial intelligence, whether or not you need a copyright license to do that. But almost all artificial intelligence models are trained on the vast universe of public domain works because there's no need for permission to use those. And so any artificial intelligence, any large language model that you interact with today, a huge part of the training data that is used for it is public domain works, for better or worse. And then the other thing that is happening is that the outputs of a lot of these AI models, they aren't protected by copyright. And so suddenly we have these machines that are creating works that are created today and enter the public domain today, which is so different than how we think about a copyright and creativity in almost all other situations.
We're talking to Michael Weinberg, who's the executive director of the Engelberg Center on Innovation, Law, and Policy at the NYU School of Law. You know, Michael, another thing that I think about a lot in relation to the public domain is net neutrality. And for listeners, that might be like, oh, I've heard of net neutrality back in the day. It's coming back up again, the latest, or maybe it's never gone away. The latest news story on the Engelberg Center's website is about net neutrality. I mean, the FCC will vote later this month on whether to restore net neutrality, which was a policy that was overturned by the Trump administration in 2017. And it basically prevents internet service providers from controlling how you access data. So like Wired, the magazine, gives the example that a cable company might slow down Netflix streaming in order to encourage you to keep their cable package. You know, I've been following net neutrality since like 2013, and it seems like we're still dealing with the same questions a decade later. Is that too reductive? And why is this a story worth following?
Yeah, it does feel like it's been going on for some time, I think, for everyone who's working on this issue. But it is an exciting time for net neutrality, because we are seeing the FCC, as you said, stepping forward to really put in place a strong net neutrality rules to prevent the company that connects you to the internet from deciding what you get to see on the internet. And there's been kind of, as you mentioned and alluded to, a number of different kind of legal and procedural steps. But the reason that this is exciting right now is that these rules that were fought for so hard, you know, 2013, 2015, to be put in place, that were then rolled back by the Trump administration, look like they're going to be brought back by the FCC. And so we will have these nationwide rules that formally prevents, as you said, your cable company, if your cable company decides, I don't know, too many people are subscribing to Netflix and cutting the cable package, maybe we should slow down Netflix so they'll have to do that. Without net neutrality rules, if they were to do that, there's no one to go to. There's no one to complain to. There's no one to step in. And so this is the FCC saying, this is our role. We are the ones who patrol whether or not internet service providers decide what websites are good, what websites are bad. They don't get that choice, and the FCC gets to have that rule. We've seen, between when the Trump administration rolled back the rules and this new action at the federal level, we did see a couple of states pass state-level net neutrality rules, which was good, but notably California. But for us here in New York, we really need that national-level protection so that we know that the cable companies, the companies that connect us to the internet, don't get to decide what parts of the internet we go to and which websites succeed and which ones fail based on the business relationship they have with Charter or Verizon.
Yeah, and this all comes back to the Public Song Project. You know, just as a reminder for listeners, you have until May 12th to submit a song to the Public Song Project. And Michael, we're asking for everyone to focus on the 1920s because of WNYC's birthday coming up. But the core idea is that we're trying to encourage people to explore and understand the public domain. So last question for you, what do you think is the most important thing that anyone thinking about this project could take away about the public domain?
I think to remember that the public domain represents the fact that we have a shared culture. All of us share this culture, and that culture is a living thing. And in order for that culture to continue to grow and be vibrant, we need to use it. And so the Public Song Project is a fantastic example of saying, we're going to take this shared culture and we're going to use it today and build on it today and make it vibrant today. And it really is what the public domain is all about, as a starting place, as a common place for all of us to dip into, to do our own creative activities. So I'm very excited about the Public Song Project, very excited to track it throughout the year.
And we've been really excited to be able to have you as part of it and to be here and to talk to us about it. Michael Weinberg is the executive director of the Engelberg Center on Innovation, Law, and Policy at the NYU School of Law. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper. with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.